This is Jason Herbert, your creator and host here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Each week we are bringing you conversations about movies and history and history and movies and movies about history and all sorts of other stuff. And this week we are talking about There Will Be Blood, the Daniel Day-Lewis epic set out in turn of the century California. And today I've got one of my academic heroes. His name is Brian DeLay. He's a professor at University of California, Berkeley. He wrote a book when I was coming out through graduate school, just came out, called War of a Thousand Deserts. It is hugely influential in borderland studies. And when I reached out to him, I was just so nervous. I was like, Brian, would you want to come on the pod? He was like, absolutely, man. Can we do this? So I just finished up the conversation with him maybe half a minute ago. And it's the coolest conversation because we really get into these ideas about what the West is, what it's like to teach the West, be a professor at a place like Berkeley, but also probably more important for you guys, these conversations about this real internal dialogue about who Daniel Day-Lewis is, Daniel Plainview's character actually is on the inside and what he's going through. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. It was a blast just to sit here and talk to Brian, who is an awesome, awesome dude. And let's get to it. So I hope your milkshakes are ready, because There Will Be Blood is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. All right, Brian DeLay, what's going on, man?
You know, living the dream, man.
Like, I'm in your dream, right? Like, I'm like in, we're just talking, like, I'm in Colorado, and you did under, are you from Colorado, or?
I am born and raised in Colorado, lived in Colorado until I was 22, went to grad school, came back to Colorado, taught at CU Boulder for 5 years, and then moved. But, you know, many ways, my heart is still in Colorado, so.
Well, mine is quite literally there right now.
I know. That's right.
When were you at CU Boulder, like teaching?
Well, okay. So I was a student there from 91 until 94. And then I taught there from 2004 until 2009.
Oh, wow. I just missed you, because I ended up, were you guys doing the Rocky Mountain Interdisciplinary History Conference over there back in like 2009?
I think it was going that, you know, that I had two little kids at that time. And so my memory's been totally ravaged by sleep deprivation. So I'm told that I lived in Colorado during those years. And I believe the people that say that, but details are hard for me to remember.
I have this 9-month-old puppy right now, and it's the closest thing that I can have to like remembering when my kids were infants, because there's no time. I live in fear at all times that he's going to destroy the house. Much like when my kids were infants. But I was just saying the other day, I ran into some folks, and I was up in Denver, and I was talking about that history conference they do there, which is specifically for graduate students. And I did that in 2012 and 13, and both fell in love with Boulder and the university, and also just like what it is they do, like promoting like this really collegial thing for graduate students learning up to like, this is how you go to a conference. This is how you present. This is how you run a panel. And You can present here without worrying about getting your head torn off, which, you know, you hear these stories. Doesn't really happen so much anymore, but on occasion you'll get some old bastard that, you know, is being a bastard or something like that. You know, it's so, yeah, I got thoughts. Where in Colorado are you from? Because we were just talking about me living in Pueblo, and I was like, Pueblo's okay.
I'm from Colorado Springs, so I'm not far away. Yeah, I was actually just there for Thanksgiving. So Colorado Springs.
Serious?
Yeah.
I was just there for Thanksgiving as well. I took my boys to the zoo.
Oh, that's very cool. I spent so much time at that zoo when I was a little kid, you know, feeding the giraffes. And did you feed the giraffes?
Oh, we fed the giraffes. It was like 18 degrees. And my kids who are from Florida were loving life. That's
you
an
know,
awesome
big
zoo.
Tongues coming up and all the steam coming up from their mouth. Yeah, it's a really funky, cool zoo. And apparently they have like one of the biggest giraffe breeding programs in the country at the Rocky Mountain Zoo at Colorado Springs.
I didn't know that giraffe sex was going to enter into the pod today, but
it's
right.
Huge. I thought that was going to be a big part of our conversation. Did I misunderstand?
No, it is now. Let's just go for it. Let's talk about ungulate eruptions. And so, you know,
there you go.
Exactly. So, all right, let's introduce you to the crowd and so forth. Who are you and what are you doing here?
So my name is Brian DeLay. I teach at UC Berkeley. I'm a historian of North America, mostly sort of 18th and 19th century North America. And I am here to talk about There Will Be Blood.
So I've been telling people all week that we're going to be doing this podcast. And everybody's like, oh my God, I love that movie. And I had to watch that movie again last night. And that is such a hard movie to watch. This is a really complicated film. And I've just got a question for you, which is, why were you like, so, you know, I know your work, like I've been the biggest fan of your stuff. I read your stuff when I was in graduate school. I read it now, but why there Will Be Blood? Like, why were you like, this is the movie I want to do?
I thought about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which I don't think you've done yet, right?
We have.
You did do that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chris Hodgson at BYU did it.
Oh, that's perfect. Okay.
Oh, he was awesome.
What a perfect choice for that.
I was just telling Brett Rushforth the other day about, because Brett, you know, Brett's a good friend of his. And I was telling, it's like, Chris is the guy that I always feel like when I'm around Chris, I'm never quite cool enough to hang around Chris. And he's like, all right, just come on anyway. It's fine. Hang out.
This is really good. So that crossed my mind. I love that movie. And I thought about a couple other ones, but you know, there's just something about There Will Be Blood. It's just such a shattering, unforgettable. I mean, you're totally right that it's a hard movie to watch, but it's also a hard movie not to watch. Like once you start it, you're just so drawn in. As hard as it is, you just cannot look away. Partly because of this cosmic performance by Daniel Day-Lewis, but I also think that movie is such a phenomenal study of a character that is simultaneously in some ways very extreme. And I actually think that most of the commentary about the movie lingers on how extreme he is and how different he is. But I don't really think that's where the magic is. I think the magic of that movie is the fact that there's so much about that character that's really normal. And that's what makes it, you know, that you just cannot look away. So anyway, I love this movie.
Yeah, you know, so I rewatched it again last night. We did it on HATM, like on the Sunday night thing some time ago. But, you know, I was sitting on the couch watching this movie last night. This is not a movie that you can sit and kind of have your phone in your hand and kind of like scroll as you're watching. This movie demands that you pay attention to it, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's right.
And the cinematography and the score just suck you in. From the very first moment where he's like working on that well and that silver mine.
No dialogue.
And nothing. And I, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis is he's so well known for being, you know, this intense, you know, method actor. I kept wondering how he prepared for this film because apparently he had like a year to get ready for it. And I can't imagine what he was going through trying to figure out how to be an oil man and a silver. I mean, so just the internal mechanics of how they make this film alone are beyond me.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. I mean, it's funny because I think with Lincoln and some of his other iconic performances, he's been a little more forthcoming about what he did to get into character and get ready. And other than, from what I could tell, his famous attention to voice and his discovery of character through voice, which is super interesting and remarkable. I didn't find a lot about the way he prepared. And in fact, he kind of makes some positive statements about, nah, this wasn't helpful. This wasn't relevant. This wasn't that. This isn't based on anything. And that's one of I actually think that's one of the reasons that it is such a compelling character study, is that he seems to kind of organically have fleshed this guy out without basing him on any particular character or history. So it's sort of a transcendent performance, I think.
It is. And like, you know, so I was sitting on the couch last night and I was actually trying to like redo his voice, just kind of try. And I'm pretty good with voices. I can do some different stuff. I can take on different accents. The only accent I can't really do is from the South. My mother, when I go home, she's like, stop trying to pretend like you're one of us. You're not. Like you left us.
Well, are you going to share with us? I want to hear.
I can't. Daniel, dude, I I cannot do a Daniel Plainview. And, you know, frankly, I don't think I can really do any of his voices because his voices are so unique. The character that, you know, I want to compare this to the most is Bill the Butcher in Gangs of New York. But it's such a radically different character as well. His voice is different. The intonations, the way he walks, the way he carries himself, his body is different. And that's the closest guy. And then you look at him and say, as far as Lincoln, again, this way, I watch him in Lincoln and he's just this guy where I forget I'm watching Daniel Day-Lewis every single time.
Yeah. I really feel like that in almost all of his movies, that I don't get the feeling of a very skilled person acting like someone.
No.
You know, I get the feeling of someone who is just so completely inhabited a character. It's pretty magical.
Do you have a favorite performance by him before we jump back into this film?
Probably this one.
Really?
I mean, I love Lincoln. I think he's incredible in Lincoln. And Phantom Thread was extremely interesting. It was a lot more subtle. At least the character is more subtle as written, but I think this is my favorite.
I'm just realizing now, I think this is like our fourth or fifth Daniel Day-Lewis movie that we've done on the pod now. Cause we just did Last of the Mohicans.
Okay. Yeah.
With Wayne Lee. With
Wayne. Yeah.
Oh man. That was such a great movie. Wayne was awesome just to talk about everything. Right. And then of course we've done, you know, we did Gangs of New York and this, and then I'm trying to think what else that we've done.
You haven't done Lincoln?
We have done Lincoln. In fact, okay. We were just talking. We did Lincoln very early on with Megan Kate Nelson and Lindsay Chervinsky.
Right.
So
that's right.
That was the other one I thought. I think Lincoln was like the fifth podcast we ever did, actually. So,
okay.
He just kind of crept up and he's been on a bunch of these. And not because we're picking Daniel Day-Lewis movies per se, but we're just picking out really fun movies to talk about. And he's just, his damn performance is just, it's just, he just chews on stuff. And
yeah.
I was talking to a friend of mine. She said, you know, the cool thing about Daniel Day-Lewis is that he elevates everybody else around him. And she was just talking about Paul Dano's performance in this film. Like, do you get Paul Dano where he's at without Daniel Day-Lewis? I don't know. But it's just like, gosh, I mean, you're arguably the best actor of his generation. I mean, I can't really place any. I mean, the only other guy I can think of is Denzel Washington. But I just don't think I don't know that anybody else has Daniel Day-Lewis's ceiling as an actor.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I do think he's sort of a singular figure for his generation. He's just so different and his range is so astonishing. And there's a virtuous circle, I think, when you reach that kind of level, which is that you, especially with his practice of doing a movie every few years, right? Or
7 years or some longer, jazz. Yeah.
That really letting it sit. I think he's long been at a place where the best filmmakers, depending on the role and everything, will approach him or you know, in other words, he's at a place where he can choose transcendently good scripts and transcendently good directors. And, so he's surrounded by a bunch of talented people that make the alchemy of a great film. But yeah, he's next level. He's just next level.
I wonder what it's like to be a director who's like working up the nerve to say, okay, I'm good enough to direct this man. And I'm good enough to tell Daniel Day-Lewis where to stand and how to say his lines. And now I'm going to go to him and say, I've got this movie. I think I got the goods. Like, and you go to the guy, you know, like, but he works with a wide range of folks.
No, that's right. He really does. And I think, I remember hearing before this movie came, this is about Magnolia, but when Magnolia came out, there was just this discourse about how this was a writer and a director that was unique, well, not uniquely, but extremely adept at eliciting remarkable performances from actors. And I remember especially this kind of discourse was surrounding Tom Cruise's performance in that movie, that there was just something about this director that he could help actors unlock potential that maybe they themselves seldom were able to unlock. And when you combine that ability, that mature ability at this point in his career with an actor like Daniel Day-Lewis, it's I think that's one of the reasons this movie's so special.
You know, there's another Tom Cruise thing that I'm thinking about as well, which is that Tom Cruise, I think one of Tom Cruise's best performances ever is actually in Collateral with Michael Mann.
Okay.
Who obviously did Last of the Mohicans as well. So you've got these guys, these guys who can really, you're just like, get these guys to come to different levels. And I don't know how you do that. But he's working with the best of the game. You know, this just – and that's what you see in this film. And not just the directors, the co-stars, the cinematographers. I mean, God.
The score, as you said. Yeah, I mean, I really – this is something that I feel quite envious about. That, you know, this is not typically how our profession works, right? The possibility of being able to work with a team of people who have extremely different strengths than you, on a shared creative project that is going to be dramatically greater than the sum of its parts. That's something I'm very jealous of, and I think would be one of the things that's so magical and fun about working on a film with a team like that.
Well, you know what? I was actually—it's funny you bring that up because I was actually looking. I looked at your CV last night as I was kind of getting prepped up and stuff like that, looking at. You know, your publication, stuff like that. And, you know, at your level, you know, you've had a lot of graduate students that have come through as well. And I got to thinking about it. And I know a few of them who have come through it and all that. And I kind of wonder if maybe that's actually some of the same ways where you've got a graduate student who's coming to Berkeley, you know, where you're at right now or whatever school. You know, there are a lot of great folks who've been on this pod who have had amazing students as well. Right. And, you know, as a student, and I just came through, right, finishing my doctorate work last year and trying to pick my team of people that I wanted to advise. And then I also had this thing, you know, I was talking to Heather, you know, Heather Richardson. She was just kind of like, hey, you know, you need to get yourself a shadow group, you know, an extra group to kind of inform, you know, this other group that kind of informs what you're doing that aren't going to sign off on your dissertation, but they're going to also be this other group that's going to read your stuff. And they might be peers. They could be other professors at other places. And I certainly had those as well. But isn't that almost kind of the thing, you know, when students are kind of coming up and, you know, writing their dissertations and they're, you know, they've got you as an advisor or maybe you're sitting on a committee. Do you get a little flavor of that as well, do you think, maybe?
I think the point about the fact that when you dig down, our work is collaborative is really true. It's true in multiple ways, right? I mean, it's obviously true in the sense that we build our work through materials that have been provided by other people, right? And it's true intellectually in terms of both directly and indirectly, the feedback and the influence that we get from other scholars and other thinkers and writers and so forth. And, you know, I suppose that it can be especially true with advisors when, you know, when you're embarking on something and you have someone that's in such, depending on the advisor, in such kind of intense dialogue with you about your work and about the project and about the potential of the dissertation. But I think it's hard to make a general rule about that. Sometimes I've felt working with students that I'm kind of there to help them get themselves out of the way, you know, that it's all inside them and I'm just trying to kind of get their own obstacles out of the way so they can get to their destination. And other students, you know, it's more of a conversation and more of a dialogue. So it really just depends on the student, I think.
Can I ask you another question? Because I'm fascinated when I talk to other professors about this transition you make from, say, student to scholar to now mentor, if you will. You know, was this an odd switch for you whenever you come up the ranks, you finish your PhD, you go to work at CU Boulder and then later on at Cal, when you find yourself all of a sudden on the opposite side of the desk and now you are the one providing advice, was there ever a moment where you're just like, wait a second, I'm the one here or anything like that? Or was it just a natural assumption of like duties as a scholar? Like, was there like a moment for you like that?
I think, you know, I'm now at the point in my career where there's part of my brain that still thinks of myself as a young scholar. But there's the other part of my brain realizes that that's not actually objectively true and no one else thinks that I'm a young scholar. And so I think the dynamic I've had with students has sort of changed over the course of my, you know, I've been mentoring students now for a long time. And so that has changed. I think when I began mentoring graduate students, I had a kind of naive view that all I needed to do was to work really hard to help them. And what I realized was that, you know, there are almost no universal rules for working with graduate students, including the rule that, you know, the more I put in, the better the outcome is going to be. Every student's different, right? Every student's got different strengths and different things that they're trying to work on. And moreover, students really change as they move through the program. I don't know about you, but almost everyone I knew in graduate school, definitely including myself, went through, you know, at least one major crisis during graduate school. And you know, you grow a lot. I mean, you know, who you are, depending on what age you are when you get into your program, you know, a lot of people come in when they're in their early 20s. By the time they're out in their late 20s or their early 30s, they're really different. And so I think that one of the most important things I've learned advising students is that the most basic thing that I have to do is just really try to listen, you know, really try to listen and understand what it is that this student and, you know, future colleague needs then at that moment from me, you know, and do my best to try to help.
I remember when I was school, and we'll go back to this in the movie in a second. I remember getting in front of my advisor, in front of David, and it was like he had this magical ability to see right when I was completely bullshitting in my work. And he would write, and I would get these messages from him sometimes. He goes, "You're writing too pretty again." He's like, yeah. he's like, you're writing around the point. He's like, "You don't want to make your point here. You're writing around it." He's like, and see, and he was just like, "When your writing gets pretty, it's when I know you're bullshitting." And I'm like, "God damn it!" You know, it was, and he was right. He was so good at that. Of course, he had, you know, many years of mentoring other smarter, better students than me, and then I just kind of flopped in front of him for a few years. But it was that experience of just like, and boy, did he, you know, it was just like, it was exactly what I needed to make me a better thinker. And, you know, there were definitely times when I was like, why is this guy busting my chops so hard, or this, that, and the other? Why doesn't he see my brilliance or whatever? But yeah. Man, it was great to like, why won't he just let me leave? But he was absolutely terrific on that. And it's, you know, it's things I think about. And I just enjoy having these conversations because I love, you know, when I was teaching, when I was finishing my dissertation, I love that mentorship aspect. So I always enjoy hearing different people talk about this.
Yeah, it's one of the best things about the career. And, you know, it's whatever the role you play in helping a younger scholar kind of launch a career, it's just a very satisfying, meaningful thing. And, you know, sometimes when you've spent your whatever day in a row of banging your head against the computer and trying to figure out how to say what you're trying to say.
Oh my gosh.
When you know that you've helped someone else realize the potential of a piece of writing that they're working on or get closer to it, then that's a really satisfying kind of balm, you know, that you feel like, okay, I know one thing I did that mattered today. So it's a really wonderful part of the job.
I want to ask you, when we talked a little earlier, you were like, this character's got all these kind of different dimensions. I want to go back to Plainview here and talk a little bit about it, because you are really gung-ho to talk about Daniel Day-Lewis as Daniel Plainview. These outside understandings of the man, maybe these internal mechanisms. What are your thoughts on – I kept trying to figure, is this our protagonist? Is this our – who is this guy? Like, why do I hate our lead guy so much? I mean, I don't like him. And I have to watch him for 2.5 hours. He's not a likable dude.
No, I think we can all agree that he is definitely not a likable character. I even rewatching. So I think I hadn't watched it in a few years. And when I rewatched it just a couple days ago, I was struck by a few things. One is that it's not really clear to me how he changes over the course of the film, which is interesting, right? A film that is so much about a character. His circumstances obviously change, but I'm not totally sure that he changes. You know, I mean, I think that in some ways, his state that we encounter him in is alone. And there are two moments in the film when he begins to think he's not alone. One is when the boy comes into his life. And I think it's just undeniable that we are made to know that he loves that child.
He does.
Like, insofar as he's capable of loving anyone, he loves that child. Like, there's just no ambiguity about that. And then the child is deafened in this accident. That is also the moment where Plainview obtains the thing that his whole life is driving towards, right? That is the moment that he discovers that ocean of oil underneath that land. And so that's very purposeful that he gets his thing that he's been fighting for his whole life, really, and loses the one person that he actually loves. And he still loves the child, but they use a real interesting artifice in the film that filmmaker does, Anderson, this of making the boy illiterate. I mean, I didn't really notice that in the first couple times I watched the film, that and it makes no sense in the context of the movie, right? This is supposed to be his partner, quote unquote, Plainview's partner, and clearly his successor, his heir, his everything. Literacy is totally critical to how business works. Plainview is obviously literate, and we're made to believe that this 10 or 11-year-old is illiterate, cannot read at all. And, you know, they drive that point home when the child is looking at the diary carried by the second person that Plainview actually has a momentary connection with, his supposed brother, half-brother, and he's holding the diary upside down and flipping it upside down. He doesn't even know that it's upside down. And I think the reason that they had us believe that kind of, frankly, pretty absurd premise is that Anderson needed Plainview to be utterly separated from this child. If they could just write notes to each other, then, you know, they could have muddled through this thing. But because they couldn't, and the only way he is able to communicate is with, he eventually learns sign language with someone other than Plainview, there's a gulf that opens up between those two. And so the first thing we see is him being bereft of this child who he clearly loves deeply. And then he thinks he's found his brother. And the only moment when we really see Plainview talk transparently about his interior state and his perspective on the world is a moment when he's sitting with this guy who he thinks is his brother. And I'm going to screw up part of this, but he says something like, are you an envious man? And the brother says, no, not really, you know. And then Plainview gives this famous line, you know, my favorite line of the book or the movie, where he says, I have a competition in me. I want no one else to succeed. You know, and it's so revealing. And it's revealing on multiple levels. Of course, we're getting a window into this thing that drives him. But the fact that he would say it out loud to another human being is also so revealing. And then, you know, the moment when they're on the beach and he begins to suspect that this man had been lying to him and he's not who he says he is. I mean, this is one of the moments where you are reminded of what a transcendently amazing actor Daniel Day-Lewis is that you could see it written on his face, this awful realization sinking into him that he'd been made a fool, that he'd allowed himself to be taken advantage of because of his need for connection, right? And that he had shared himself, that he had actually revealed himself to someone who wasn't who he said he was, like under false pretenses. And it's all flashing across his face wordlessly. It's such an incredible, incredible moment. So anyway, I just think that, you know, he starts alone. There's these couple of moments where he's briefly connected to another human being and he ends alone. But I don't know that the character changes at all. His circumstances change. He gets all the riches that he had been fighting for. It doesn't make him happy at all, you know, but the character himself is weirdly static. And it's funny because, you know, I don't know how you get a character that's that compelling who doesn't change. But I'm not so sure he changes.
No, and that's traditionally a thing, right? You have the character arc where the character, you start the character, they go through trials, and then they emerge on the other side a changed person.
Yeah.
Usually a better person. And the only thing we really see is that he actually sinks deep into alcoholism towards the very end, right?
That's right. That's
where
right.
He's shunning everyone around him, including HW. When HW comes back, you know, you had mentioned HW's, who by this point in time is obviously deaf. The man who taught him sign language serves as his best man at his
wedding. Exactly. Exactly. Plainview's not even there.
No. And Plainview knew the daughter, like the, you know, Eli's.
And seemingly was affectionate towards her.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Almost a little weird.
It was almost a little weird.
Because we never see Plainview with a woman at all. And that's not necessary for the human experience. But traditionally you would, this guy would find something. And there's
even in the brothel, like he's in the brothel with his supposed brother, and his brother is, you know, going for it. But Plainview's just sitting there stewing. Yeah. Basically, we learn, you know, planning that he's going to kill this guy. And there's an interesting moment when in that incredibly important scene where Eli forces him to kind of admit his sins. One of the sins that Eli lists off is like fornication or something. He had fornicated with women. And it's interesting they threw that in there because, of course, he never does that. And it's as if what they were trying to do was to highlight the degree to which most of these accusations were totally meaningless to Plainview. Sure, okay, I fornicated. Sure, I took the guy, you know, I did this, I did that. No, it doesn't matter. But then when he insists that he says, you abandoned your son, you know, it's just the pain of having to actually acknowledge that was so palpable. It's amazing.
You see that when he is meeting with the Standard Oil guys too, when the guy just says, yeah, you'll have more time with your kid.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Like you would say to anybody, right, hey, if you graduate, you know, you get $1 billion or, you know, you retire, you spend more time on the, you know, with your kids in France or whatever. You say, yeah, that sounds great, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And Plainview just takes it as such a direct, as like an insult, right?
And again, this time, for the first time on rewatching it, that scene, it occurred to me that the guy from Standard Oil is so warm, such a glad hander, such a, you know, it's he almost doesn't belong in this movie kind of figure. And it's all fake. You know, I mean, it's so there's something about, this is kind of what I was saying about the qualities that are in him in Plainview that are more normal or not as exceptional. He's got the same drive as these guys from Standard Oil. It's not like these guys from Standard Oil lack ambition or ruthlessness, obviously, right? But there's a kind of facade of win-win and we're all going to be chums here. And there's something kind of weirdly admirable about Plainview's refusal to go along with the bullshit. You know, it's like, you're my enemy. I'm your enemy. Like, let's quit the bullshit. You know, there's something about and he takes it to an almost psychotic level, obviously. Like, literally, when he says, I'm going to go to your house and I'm going to cut your throat while you're sleeping. But there's still something about the implausibly friendly demeanor of the ruthless corporate titan that I thought was an interesting kind of critique in the way that the filmmaker put this all together.
You know, I kind of wonder, you know, this film is based on Upton Sinclair's novel Oil to a degree. And I kind of wonder historically, like, to what degree is this guy really present in history as far as who were these men who were heading out to California? This film's out because I want to talk to you a bit about the West and California as the West, which is not typically a place that I tend to think of when we think about the West, but why wouldn't it be? You know, I wonder about these men who go out and go into the mines, go into prospecting, things like that. We're just talking about in academia, there's no such thing as a self-made man. And of course, you know, for the longest time, we are kind of taught that those people exist, that's kind of a myth, this idea of the mountain man. Of course, you know, nobody's self-made, but I just kind of wonder, does this guy exist in the world in the late 1800s, the early 1900s? Who were these men out there who were, you know, these early small oil barons, you know, who were out there trying to create the world? I don't know. It's beyond my wheelhouse a little bit.
Well, it's beyond my wheelhouse too. I'm not a historian of either of California or of the late 19th, early 20th century or of the oil industry. So, I mean, I'm a little out of my depth when it comes to that, but I can tell you that researching the 19th century, I do have often felt that there is a form of kind of masculine culture that, I mean, you know, there's a, you don't have to look very far to find kind of martial manhood, as Amy Greenberg puts it, of, you know, today, obviously, but there's something about the hardness of so many characters in the 19th century, the ruthlessness, the kind of bulldozer willingness to just go through anyone and everything in pursuit of what they're after. I think it's still very much with us, but it's, I think, you know, it depends on the realm we're talking about. It's often masked, as I say, again, with like this guy from Standard Oil didn't get there by being a nice guy. So I do think that he's drawn in ways that are a little over the top, but I don't think they're as over the top as we might like to think they are. You know, and I think that there's also something about the electric performance that makes it seem singular. But I mean, I think Daniel Plainview is a little more regular than we may want to believe.
You know, I also work in the 19th century for a big portion of the area that I talk about. And I think one of the interesting things historically is, like, we're talking about Standard Oil, and of course the guy we're talking, John Rockefeller, is one of these guys who is just cutthroat. I mean, Captain Cutthroat is who he is. You know, and there are these, I think it's one of the fascinating things about the era when we look at, there are so many of these titans so forth that we're kind of alluded to, and really Plainview is a small fish in this pond. He's not, oh, yeah. You know, he easily could have been gobbled up by Standard Oil, Union Oil. I don't know if you can hear, there's actually a railroad going back and forth. There's a train going back and forth outside my house as we're talking.
Me too. And I have a park train going outside my house. So.
Oh, okay. So, right. You know, and I'm thinking about these titans, these railroad titans, these oil titans. This is really a fascinating time period, you know, in American history.
I agree. Totally.
Filled with these, I mean, these characters, I guess, is what it feels like to me.
No, I agree. And I actually think that this is another aspect of Plainview's character that, again, so much of the commentary that I saw about this film emphasizes or claims that, you know, what this fundamentally is a critique of capitalism, that Plainview is sort of like the dystopian avatar of where capitalism inevitably leads or something like this. I am skeptical that Anderson had that in mind when he wrote this thing. I think he's just a lot more complicated and interesting than that. I mean, I think, you know, the way that he is almost constitutionally incapable of allowing the big guys to win, even when it's going to make him insanely rich, you know, he just can't bear it. You know, there's a way in which he knows that they look down on him and he's going to be damned if he's going to let them win. You know, it doesn't matter what I have to do. You're not going to, I'm going to screw up your plans, you know? And so, I mean, he would even go to the length of that crushing, humiliating, agonizing performance in the church, where he, you know, this incredibly private man who's a total misanthrope, that views everyone that's in that town as, you know, these people, as he says, with just contempt dripping off his lips, right? But he's going to go before them and go down on his knees and confess his most painful sins and the things that he feels most ashamed of in his world. Like, he's willing to do that to stop Standard Oil from winning. Even if losing meant that he was going to be rich. So there's just something about that that is more complicated and interesting, you know, than a one-dimensional kind of avatar of capitalism's excesses or something like that.
Yeah, there's no interest in happiness for this guy. Like, happiness is never the goal for this guy.
Yeah, or that's a really interesting way to put it. I mean, happiness is not the goal, or he has just not stopped for a single second to think about what that means. You know, he's maniacally in pursuit of something. And one would think that he imagines that happiness will be there. And there is that moment again, on the beach, he's talking to this guy he thinks is his brother. And he's like, where would you build your house? Maybe right here on the beach. You know, it's like he does have a future in mind. And eventually he ends up with that glorious mansion on the beach, but he's never happy.
No, I think the closest we see to happiness is when he's with HW early on. But it's never a conscious thing like I'm happy, but it's clearly in the love that he's got for the child who he inherits through tragedy early on and, you know, kind of steals the kid. I mean, it's just, but that's his moment of happiness is selling other people on the idea. And this is my partner. It's my son, HW. Oh, there's my Daniel Day-Lewis voice.
I can hear it. Yeah.
Well, I can't do the milkshake part. Maybe I can just kind of get into it. It's just like, just listen to the podcast and we'll keep going. There so go.
John Huston meets Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, that's right. That's who he based his voice off of.
Well,
right?
It's interesting because that's what people say. And I think he seems to have taken a little umbrage at the idea that it came from only one source. But you know, that idea about happiness, there's a really small detail, but I ended up thinking it was actually really meaningful. Near the very end, where the grown son is coming and telling him how much he loves him and trying to explain why he feels he needs to start his own business, it's really moving, actually. He says, I want to return to the work I love. You taught me to love it. You know, being outdoors, working out there, you know, and it's this real moment of truth telling where he is. I do think actually Plainview, that's when he was happy, right? Not when he's sitting in his bowling alley, you know, drinking himself to death. It was when he was out there working, especially as you say, with his son. And the son knew that and wanted to try to recapture some of that for himself. And Plainview was totally contemptuous and unwilling to give him anything. It was such a dark and heartbreaking and horrible moment.
Now you're my competitor.
Yeah.
The guy's just telling you, all I want to do is be like you. And it's hard. It's absolutely heartbreaking, right? I mean, and you don't blame HW when he leaves.
Not at all. No. He had incredible restraint.
I want to ask you about Paul Dano.
Okay.
And his character, Eli. What are your thoughts on him, on the role of the church in this film?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know what I think about that. It's such an important part of the movie. I can imagine Anderson wanting us to believe two things. One being that those people, as Plainview contemptuously calls them, actually get something sustaining and nourishing and affirming out of faith. And that those men like Plainview and maybe like Eli, who are so on the make that they cannot see it. I could imagine Anderson having done that, but he didn't do that, I don't think. I think that basically he left us with little material to think that Plainview was wrong, that religion was an opiate for the, you know, the unthinking masses. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think about it? I mean, I haven't figured out what I think of the whole religion aspect of the movie.
You know, I'll tell you this. You know, I grew up in a Southern Baptist family in Western Kentucky, right? So, and I very quickly, my family's still very, very religious, and I bailed as fast as I possibly could. And so when I see religion on screen now, I'm always like, and again, this is my personal, I'm always skeptical. I'm just like, I've been through this. You know, I've sat through a lot of that, those moments. And I got to tell you, watching the movie, all I really wanted to do was just watch Daniel Day-Lewis in this movie. I kept thinking as I was watching through this and really more afterwards, I was like, you know, this could be a one-man play that I would watch. Like, I think I could just watch Daniel Day-Lewis do this. I don't even know that the rest of the cast is necessary for me to enjoy this film so much as I can just watch Daniel Day-Lewis reflect on other people around him and stew for 2 hours. And just slowly, you know, fall into madness. I don't know. And the ending of this thing between himself and Aline is just so abrupt and brutal and violent.
It's I remember the first time I saw it thinking, what? You know, I mean, it just again, yeah, like you, I felt it's just too abrupt. I don't, what the hell just happened? This time it made more sense to me. I mean, I came away thinking, okay, he didn't like Eli from the very beginning. I mean, at all.
Always hated him.
Obviously. I mean, he already basically hates this guy and thinks of him not as one of the contemptible people he's compelled to deal with, but as a competitor. He's on the make, just like Plainview himself, right? Eli's on the make, and he's doing it in a different way and an even less honest way, and walks around with this holier-than-thou thing, and it really drives him crazy. And you can see that in the moment when Plainview beats him up and rubs oil all over his mouth and stuff like that. And it's after that that Eli makes him do this humiliating, searing thing in the church and probes until he finds that nerve about his son and then just, you know, keeps on slamming it. When Plainview is passed out in the bowling alley and Eli's trying to wake him up, we see the back of Plainview's head and Eli finally says, "It's me, Eli." And you see his head lift off the floor from the back, and he says, "Yes, it is." And then he gets up, and he slaps himself a bunch of times, and he does a little jig. He dances with, like, this dance of unbelievable joy and luck.
Oh, he knows.
He knows.
I'm going to kill this man.
He's like, the only thing left for me to do, the only thing I've left to do, the only thing I want is just – like fallen in my lap. And it's so dark, but you know, to me, it made a lot more sense having watched it now, like whatever, the third or fourth time. It's sort of like there was this symmetry that somehow I didn't quite get before.
Well, yeah, definitely, right? Like, because he's forcing Eli into making a confession.
Yes.
As well, to get what he
God
wants.
God is a fraud, and you know, I'm a huckster, or whatever it is.
I'm a false prophet, whatever it is, right? Yeah. And then, of course, we get the milkshakes. Did you read behind this on, like, where the milkshake comes from?
I didn't. Do you know?
The milkshake, which sounds so weird initially, actually comes from testimony in the Teapot Dome scandal.
Okay.
Which was used by people confessing about selling oil lands or lands for oil or so forth. It actually comes directly out of that. And you, like, this movie set in the desert in California. And why are you people talking about milkshake? And it, my God. And you talk about this movie, everybody thinks about this one line.
Yeah, it's such a kind of maniacal. That's really interesting, and it makes a lot of sense. So that scene, apparently, if I'm remembering this right, that was filmed in Edward Doheny's mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently this is the oil baron that Oil was loosely based on, the book. And, you know, Doheny, I think, was a big figure in the teapot scandal. So there's like these weird echoes that kind of run throughout the book. But it's funny because there's very few, I think, homages to history in the movie, far fewer than one could have imagined. Anderson just didn't seem very interested in doing that. So it's intriguing that at that very end, he decided to make that kind of a nod to history.
I keep thinking about these films, obviously, now in terms of like history and what does this mean and what's this reflecting and things like that. Oil in the West. Obviously, we've just seen Killers of the Flower Moon just came out. I'm talking about that, thinking about. I kept thinking as I'm watching this about the Native peoples who were in California, who we do not see in this particular
film. Totally, not even indirectly mentioned.
Not at all. In fact, I was just I wrote about this last night. You know, Kevin McCarthy, former Speaker of the House, was just like, "Hey, the United States has never taken land from anyone after a war," and that's complete bunk. And I kind of want to, maybe if we can talk just briefly a little bit about maybe some of the work that you've done and this idea of the West and so forth. I have to tell you, your first book is like one of my most favorite things I've ever read. I love it so much. I hope this isn't embarrassing you. I think it's maybe my favorite titled book of all time, that or Mark Kurlansky's Cod. I don't know. You know, I was hoping maybe we could talk a little bit about like how you came to write about the West and then also what you're doing right now. Cause you're doing some different stuff now than originally. And maybe kind of talk a little bit about that transition for yourself as like a scholar. Where's your character arc going, Brian? and will you end up in a bowling alley when you're 75, you know? So chasing down graduate students.
Yeah, that's right. Well, so, you know, thank you very much for saying that. And my, that book, that first book is a book called War of a Thousand Deserts. And it is a study of how Native people influenced the era of the U.S.-Mexican War. You know, that book, I went to graduate school thinking that I was going to work on the history of the American Revolution. And specifically, I thought I was going to be working on crowd action in the era of the American Revolution. That's what I went to grad school to do.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And wow. Okay. In my very first semester in grad school, Richard White, the historian Richard White, and historian James Merrill, and the historian Alan Taylor, all three of them came and gave talks at Harvard. And my mind was blown, and I was so excited and interested in what they were doing. And I just decided, you know, I need to work on Native American history. I just have to. So I tried reconciling these a little bit by working on Native history in New England. That's kind of the first research I did in graduate school. And it ended up being an extremely mediocre paper. And coinciding also with a feeling of being really depressed and unhappy in graduate school and feeling totally outmatched. I mean, you know, I felt like I was surrounded by all these people who knew a lot and I didn't know anything.
That's common. Yeah. That was my experience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's certainly how I felt. And, you know, it wasn't just a feeling. There was a lot of ways in which it was definitely true. I ran kind of randomly, just because of the way that classes were offered in the following semester, there was a seminar on the economic history of Latin America taught by a very distinguished and a wonderful professor named John Coatsworth. So I ended up just taking that. I had to take a class, and there was very few other things available. And John Coatsworth, very kindly, for my final paper, he allowed me to write a paper about the far north of Mexico or the American Southwest. And that was kind of a life-changing moment because I got into that historiography and I felt, now this is, you know, mind you, this is like 1997. And nowadays there's all kinds of rich, exciting work that's been done on the far northern borderlands. But at that time in 1997, it was a much thinner kind of historiography. And in terms of big books, the kind of books that are assigned, you know, around the country for graduate students and stuff, there were only a handful, only a couple really. And so my perception was, having spent some time under, you know, getting into the historiography of Native people in the Eastern Seaboard, was that, wow, it's wide open in northern Mexico and the U.S.-Mexican borderlands when it comes to Native American history. There's so much that can be done here. And the persistence of indigenous power in this place, and that's the thing I was most interested in at this time in the mid-90s, was really striking. And so I just kind of reinvented myself as a borderlands historian and ended up writing a dissertation about Native power in the U.S.-Mexican borderlands that kind of ended up gravitating more and more towards this extremely important moment, the U.S.-Mexican War. And what I discovered was that histories of this conflict between the United States and Mexico, and then to a certain extent the Texan Republic, had largely been written about a contest between states. And it didn't compute with me because I knew that, in fact, Native people controlled almost all the territory that these states were contending over. And so I was like, you know, is it really possible that these Native polities were just not relevant to this contest? That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And the more I got into the primary sources, the more I realized it wasn't true. And so that book was my attempt to explain how Native people and Native politics in particular helped shape the contest between the nation states and then shape the outcome that, you know, transformed North America.
That book came out, when was it? 2007, 8? I forget exactly.
2008. Forgive me.
2008.
Yep.
That's 15 years now, and I'm still quoting it to you. Does this still happen? Because I consider it to be a foundational text, at least for me, because I'm like, I dig it in the ways, and I hope I don't sound like I'm fanboying over here, but like, you know, I think about in terms of like, I think about like David J. Weber stuff and, you know, just classical borderlands kind of like, this is, for me, this is just cool ass shit. Cause I mean, I actually have an entire, I you know, so I kind of wonder, Do you still have people come to you based on that work, your scholars, or is it, you know, the new stuff that you're doing? Because you've got a new book on firearms, right? You've two books. What you've got?
Yeah.
Two books,
so
right?
You know, I ended up taking a pretty major detour. Well,
yeah,
maybe not the right word, but going in a really different direction.
First,
let me just say how happy it makes me to appear in the same sentence as David Weber. I mean, so.
I wish I'd met him.
David was an incredible friend and mentor to me, and such an important scholar, and just an absolute prince of a human being. And there, you know, loads of us in the profession will say the same thing. So just all homage to the great David Weber. But when I finished that first book, I was ready to do something pretty different. After playing around with a few different topics, I decided that I wanted to write hemispheric history, and I was just in search of the thing that would bind it together. And I have learned a lot from comparative history, but I didn't. I really am a storyteller. I care a lot about writing, and I wanted to find a story. And you know, it was a challenge to figure out what the story was that's operating on a hemispheric scale. And I won't bore you with the details, but eventually I realized that, you know, the arms trade is a story that links the entire hemisphere together. And it's a story that historians have mostly ignored, you know, or if they've written about it, they've written about it just in very specific places and times. And so I set out to write a book. Initially, it was all about Native people and the international arms trade in the Americas. And I didn't get very far down the track before I realized that, you know, one of the big things I feel so strongly about as a scholar, and I've tried to do in most of my work, is to de-exoticize Native American history and to insist that, you know, this is not some separate special category of history. It is history. And the more that I got into this story about the movement of weapons and ammunition around the hemisphere, the more I realized, you know, the problem that Comanches are facing or that Mayans are facing in the mid-19th century in the Yucatan is not that different from the problem that the Confederate States of America faced, or that George Washington faced, right? Or that Simon Bolivar faced, or that Toussaint Louverture faced, right? I mean, all these different political projects that needed organized violence in order to achieve their goals and did not have the capacity to make their own weapons. They had to tap into the international arms trade. So I just decided I'm just going to tell the whole story. And I spent a ton of time doing research in Europe because that's where most of the guns came from. And a bunch of time tromping around different archives in the United States and in Mexico. And when I began writing, this is about 5 or 6 years ago now, maybe more, maybe 8 years ago, I told myself, okay, I'm going to have a chapter on the American Revolution, and then I'm going to have a chapter on the Haitian Revolution, the Spanish-American Wars for Independence, and then I'm going to be off to the races in what's the heart of the story, which is a 19th and early 20th century story, is what I thought. So this thing that was going to be a chapter on the American Revolution, you know, it ended up ballooning into more than 100 pages, and I thought, okay, that's okay for the American Revolution. It's the beginning of the story. I can't let that happen anymore. Now I'm going to turn the page. And I started with the Haitian Revolution, and I thought, this is going to take me a couple months. It's going to be end up being, you know, whatever, 20 pages. And a year later, I had more than 100 pages on the Haitian Revolution, and I finally came to terms with the fact that this is a book. This is a separate book. So the revolutionary era is a separate project, and I got another contract for this separate book. My editor was a little unhappy about it initially. Finally convinced him, okay, this makes sense. Then I told myself, all right, now I just have to do these other two components here. You know, I'm going to do this story of anti-colonial rebellion throughout the hemisphere. But of course, I cannot write this book without a very significant Native American history component, nor should I write this book without a very significant engagement with slavery and anti-slavery rebellion in the period. But I should be able to do this pretty quickly, is what I tell myself. So I got another leave. And I initially started with Shawnees. I knew that I wanted to focus on a particular polity. And eventually that didn't really work out the way I wanted it to. And finally, I realized that the Cherokees were the group that really, you know, illuminated the story I wanted to tell. That took me another couple of years to really figure all that out. And so now the book is, I finally have the shape. I've got another few chapters I have to write. It's mostly done. And the Cherokee story is the kind of chord that runs from the beginning to the very end of the book. So I got to finish this. Then I will turn to the book that I, you know, promised my editor I was going to write, you know, 10 years ago or 12 years ago, which is basically a 19th and 20th century story.
Did you get a chance to spend any time in Cherokee country when you were researching this at all?
I have not yet done that. So this is something I want to talk to you about. Is, you know, I've passed through, I've done a little bit of, you know, tourist type activity, but I haven't really done anything that the kind of work that I need to do. Partly because, you know, this the revelation that the Cherokee story was the story I had been looking for came to me during the pandemic. And so anyway, this is to be continued after the...
Yeah. I'll just tell you. It's maybe my favorite place in the continental United States. Wow. I was up in Cherokee about a year ago, visiting my friends up there in the Eastern Band of Cherokee. And oh my gosh, for folks listening in, go to Cherokee, North Carolina. That's Jason's quick tour guide. I want to ask you though quickly. Your publishing is it with Norton on this one?
Yeah,
it's a trade press with this, right?
Right.
I was kind of wondering, you know, if you can talk a little bit about the differences in, say, writing towards trade press. The way you write, I don't know that it's going to change, but was there a conscious decision in writing style or direction or decision about audience when you're writing, say, to a what we refer to as a trade press versus, say, a university press? Is there a change there for you? I mean, how does that work?
I think I have a little bit of a different view about this than many colleagues of mine.
Oh, please.
I have smart, valued colleagues who kind of think that these are categorically different sorts of enterprises, you know, writing for an academic press versus writing for a trade press. And these are often not people that you know, are opposed to writing for a trade press, but they think of it as categorically different. I don't really see it like that. First of all, trade presses are different, just like university presses are different, right? There's just a bunch of different presses out there, and they have different catalogs and different kinds of commitments and so forth. I think that trade press editors, like academic press editors, care about books, and they want to publish good books, good, meaningful books, and they love what they do. So I think in that sense, it's sort of apples to apples. There are big differences. So one obvious difference is that with trade presses, there's a peer review component that's hardwired into the process. And that's not true with trade presses. Most authors who, you know, certainly most academic authors who write for trade presses are going to have a lot of peer review along the way. It's just not going to be blind peer review. And that makes a difference. But, you know, I don't think maybe it's as big of a difference as some people think. The more important difference, I think, is that when we're writing for academic presses, it's understood that we are primarily writing for the guild. History is an accessible discipline more than many other social sciences. And so, you know, I think that most good editors for history books, certainly American history books at university presses, are going to maybe dissuade authors from being too heavy on jargon and so forth and so on. But still, the expectation is that we're pitching our arguments to peers. You know, or peers in the making, graduate students and so forth. And trade presses explicitly are about audience. They want a broad audience, right? And so they're not, my experience is that trade editors are not very interested in hearing you speak only to a narrow audience, right? That is to say, the guild. They like arguments and they care about arguments. I think the better presses and editors are very deeply invested in meaningful arguments, but they don't think of those things as coming primarily in terms of an intra-guild conversation. They want arguments that other informed literate readers are going to care about. You know, I cannot speak what it's like to be a published trade author because I've been working on this goddamn book forever and ever. It's not done
yet.
Yeah.
It's coming.
But I certainly, you know, look, you know, I mean, there's a reason this book has taken me like 15 years is that I care a lot about the work and I never feel sort of satisfied with an initial answer. I'm always wondering, well, wait a minute. If I read more sources, is that really going to hold up? And sometimes that just is a giant waste of time. But a lot of times it ends up taking me in a direction that I never could have thought about before. And I think that, you know, if I live long enough for this book to actually appear, it's going to, what's good about it is very much going to come from the fact that I, you know, took the time to chase all this down and to keep asking questions and to constantly be second guessing what it is I think that is initially true. And my experience so far with a trade press editor is that the right trade press editor, I mean, I think mine is, you know, has been really great for me, is that they're open to that. I think they would have been thrilled if I would have been done with this book 5 years ago. But the you know, I've not had someone breathing down my neck and saying, I don't care if it's ready, we need it now. Now, I know that could happen with other trade presses and stuff. I guess my big message is just that I, in my own experience, is that it's a spectrum and that academic presses and trade presses kind of overlap. And the more kind of scholarly oriented trade presses are totally invested in serious history. But they have a capacity to reach an audience that few or no academic presses have.
I love what you just said, because I keep thinking about the importance. I think that for a long time there's been this pushback in the academy about against trade presses and things like that. But for folks who don't know this history, they're not going to go to XYZ University Press to buy that book. They're going to Barnes & Noble or Amazon or whatever, and they're buying from Norton or not or any number of the trades. And I feel like if I write these books to the same people who I know, nothing changes. There's no dissemination of knowledge. You still have people saying that the United States has never taken land from anybody.
That's a little bit of a special case. I think I'm not so sure Kevin McCarthy is as dumb as he appears, but we can bracket that for a minute.
I think he's playing to an audience on that. I think he's being willfully ignorant.
This is a lot. I mean, the first thing that I thought when I heard that quote is Sean Spicer up there before the reporter saying, this is the biggest crowd in the history of presidential inaugurations, which is basically 2 + 2 = 5. Like, that's what absolutely. I think McCarthy's. But anyway, that's a little bit of a different conversation.
It is. But you see enough of that, right, where people just completely. And again, you know, the great triumph in history, story of the United States, the Mexican War, we just barge on in, you know, and it's ours. Right. And there's no Comanche. There's no Apache. There's no indigenous peoples there whatsoever. So, no, I get it.
The guy is a congressman from California, for God's sake. You know, I mean, give me a break.
I kept thinking, it's like, has this man never read Benjamin Madley? I mean, I was just like, I don't know. So, all right, I want to bring this back to the films this far. What are your final thoughts here on There Will Be Blood? Is this a movie you can watch over and over again? You were gung-ho to watch it. When are you going to watch it next? Do you bust this movie out with the kids and say,
Well, my son's about to turn 21. So, I mean, he's getting to the point where I can imagine.
He might dig it.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine watching it with him. I can't imagine not watching this again. I mean, I certainly felt like, having not seen it now for maybe 5 or 6 years, watching it again, I saw all kinds of things I didn't see before and understood it at a level I didn't before. You know, I've alluded to this a few times, but I read a few interviews with Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis, and I kind of got the impression that they were content, at least Anderson in particular, was content to let people read whatever they wanted to in the thing. And I do think that that is in some ways a mark of a mature artist, where I don't buy that he was out. This was designed as a critique of anything in particular. I think that it was it's a work of art illuminating something about the human condition. You know, and that's the thing that makes it, that rewards rewatching, right? That it's just the combination of that wonderful script and the transcendent actor. There's a lot to learn and to ponder. You know, I mean, most stuff I watch, it's fine. I watch it, I enjoy it or whatever, and then I don't really think about it. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that, like, I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm thinking about.
All right. Well, let me ask you our final question then. Is this a history movie?
Yeah. You know, I'm not so sure. It's obviously set in the past, but I honestly didn't leave this film thinking that the writer director was especially interested in the past, in history. I think it's more of a setting for a story that he thought was worth telling. You know, you mentioned before the fact that we encounter no indigenous people, which I suppose wouldn't be so surprising, but I think it is surprising and really notable that we don't even hear about indigenous people. You know, you have all these rough figures who are invested in and responsible for the rapid transformation of California, and none of them say anything about Native people. Nor do we ever hear anyone speak Spanish in this movie. You know, even Oil, the book, mentions, you know, Californios and Spanish speakers. And so there's a kind of indifference to the actual history of the place that doesn't really bother me, honestly, because I think that, you know, again, that's not what he was trying to do. I think he was trying to tell a transcendent story about a remarkable, deeply disturbing figure, but that is disturbing partly because he's familiar. So I don't know. I guess I would say on balance that I don't really think it's a history movie.
That's good enough, man. Brian, where can people find you? Where can people find you writing the transcendent stories of the past that are history books?
Well, you know, I mean, all the stuff that I have done and am doing is on my departmental website. You know, it's just easy to find me on the Berkeley History webpage. I don't post so much on Twitter anymore for a bunch of reasons.
Good for you.
You probably relate to. One of them being that I've gotten involved in a lot of Second Amendment cases around the country over the past year, and have discovered when I go to trial that my Twitter file is a giant Oppo research goldmine for for gun rights lawyers and so forth. So I've kind of fallen silent on Twitter more or less. But my departmental website is probably the best place.
Awesome. Brian, thank you so much for being here. This was awesome.
Yeah, Jason, thank you. I had a blast. Really appreciate it.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of Movies podcast. Thank you so very much to our guest, Brian DeLay, for being here today. Brian, just I was just geeking out talking to you all day. Like, I think it's probably obvious for anyone who just listened to the last hour. But thank you so much for being here. Thank you again to our intrepid producer, Fletcher Powell, for making this show run. And thank you most of all to you guys for coming back to listening to these podcasts week in, week out, for telling your friends about this, continue to support what we're trying to do here. You guys mean the absolute world to me. I hope you loved the pod today. I loved bringing it to you, and looking forward to bringing to you another one next week. So ciao for now. Bye.